Guys, thank you for tuning in to a special episode of the Traveling Hoopers podcast. We're still in our book club series for Black Ball, and we're really excited to read this book. It is by Teresa Runstetter. Hopefully you've seen her through social media or all of the TV spots that she's been doing over the last couple weeks to get more word out on this book. And we're going to be reviewing it, and we're in section two, which deals with the chapters called, I was just on the page, I promise you I was, Black Players Flood the League, and chapter five, Professional, Simon Gordine and the NBA's White Ceiling. Guys, let's go ahead and just like do a quick breakdown of like chapter four. That seemed like a necessary yet messy chapter, especially if you have, it almost reads like a black exploitation film at some points. And I don't mean that in like a bad way. I'm talking about like how things unfold for certain people around drugs and almost kind of being policed for being flashy, even though you can afford to be flashy. It's like a lot of weird things in there. And Philip, you had a interesting point about how the, as more black players came into the league, it seemed like they were policing especially African-American players a lot harder than they had been in the past.
Do you want me to get into that now? Because I believe that's the next chapter. I could be right, wrong though. No, it's, you're right, this is the next chapter, excuse me. So there's two points I want to make on this chapter specifically, right? But to smooth transition it from what you just mentioned, there is a, do you mind if I read a little bit of the chapter? So it says, shortly after the arrest of Jabbar and Allen in November 1972, the NBA quietly established its first security office run by ex-FBI agent Jack Joyce. And by June 1973, Joyce claimed to have a network of security men in each NBA city who reported to him on a weekly basis. This does not happen until NBA-ABA mergers. This does not happen until certain circumstances of where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Allen were in a an unfortunate circumstance, dealing with a car and so on and so forth. This does not happen until business decides that they want to police black bodies. That is a very important understanding that one needs to have about the fundamentals of modern sports. Because this does not just stop now or just stop in 1973. This is the beginning of what sports would turn into all the way into present day 2023. And we had just seen it from Ja Morant currently in the NBA scene, where nothing is done wrong. Right? You have the NRA, for instance, fighting over the rights to bear arms, but you didn't see none of them out with Ja Morant, right? You don't see all these first, all these, you know, rights to bear arm individuals, you know, who are Second Amendment, who are ready to, you know, fight to the death they have to, when the individuals who are enforcing and using these lawful laws themselves are black bodies. And that goes from a personal standpoint on an everyday basis, but that translates easily to professional sports, which is a business, and business is not ran ethically or morally, and that's what makes business business. And I think this is a fine indication of that point.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And it's like, it's down to the conduct in itself. Like, we're seeing policing even from, like, the media or, like, fans whose biggest issue does not solely seem like the tickets are high priced, and even in the situations where the tickets are really expensive,
right,
instead of blaming the owners who actually control prices, you'd rather go after the professional athletes that's on the floor. And we already know what that is stemming from. It's much easier.
Because this also came to mind. You have many generations that you might have heard before, and definitely the generation before us was, you know, the rhetoric, a common rhetoric at least, was you have to work 100% harder than the person, than the white person, essentially, working 100% next to you, right? However hard they work, you got to work harder. And this is like an indication of where, like, not that mindset came from, but where that mindset continued to be established, right? Because if something goes wrong, then you are going to be held more liable than peers around you. And that goes for, and, you know, this goes into a whole, this generation, our generation, you will hear this term tossed out called respectability politics. Mm-hmm. And not trying to reform to the status quo, I guess you would call it. But I have often enough argued that that's taking context out of the scenario, and the status quo is the status quo because it is built and has been built to repress you. So you have to do anything you can to combat that. Now, people can go back and forth about, like, they agree with that or disagree with that. I don't think right now that necessarily matters for this conversation, but I think matters for this conversation is that this is a reality and has been a reality since the founding of this country. But in terms of sports, this book does a really good job at pinpointing and showcasing those different aspects without telling the audience that's what's happening. So it allows the audience to think for themselves also while giving them just accurate information.
So what I will say, right, for the given, I guess, time frame that these handful of chapters occurred in, right, which at that point, mid to late 70s, right? Right, the civil rights movement relative to the beginning of the book is a little bit further behind, but not that far behind. Like, the grown people that were there for the civil rights movement were still alive and well. Well, those that didn't get shot, but or, you know, otherwise died from various other means. But what I think, right, the general thing with what's going on at that point is, well, one, right, it's not like white people magically became super not racist after the I Have a Dream speech or whatever nonsense a certain sector of people frequently want to spew. Right, but, like, now there's a lot of bad stuff that a lot of them used to do that you can't legally do no more. But, like, a lot of that sentiment and feeling is still there for them. And something that you will see throughout history is, I'm not sure if I'm phrasing this correctly, but, like, white grievance politics is a very salient force in American politics. And that most frequently shows up in the book and in this section when we start to talk about how the fans reacted to so-and-so doing such-and-such or whatever, right? And, of course, we still have, you know, stereotypes that hold a lot of sway, particularly as we're beginning to get into the crack epidemic, for which I blame the CIA, if memory serves. That might be the wrong alphabet organization. But you were seeing a lot of discussion about, you know, black players' drug use and the like. Never mind the fact, you know, the white players do it too, but you know they don't really care for real. But there's also an element of, you know, as discussed in the book, class, where you see black men in a, you know, effectively a higher class than a lot of the white fans, right?
Right.
So, of course, right, they see a, you know, one of these well-to-do black men who make money playing a game because you continue to spend money to watch them play this game, even as you complain and want to jump into the fights that are happening on the... People are stupid. See both, like, in the context of this, of, like, the NBA in particular, but also as they progress into, like, the 80s and whatnot, you see a lot of that white grievance politics that, can be mobilized to do a lot of harm even to white people, or as long as you can get them to believe that it harms black people more, right? That, and, like, that resentment that some of the fans feel for, again, well-to-do black men making money because you spend money to watch them play a game. There's a lot of stuff lost on a lot of people historically. I feel like I had a point somewhere, but I'm just going to stop here until we get around to the next thing.
All right. So while reading chapter 4, I was, like, physically upset, like, recalling some of these people's experiences. Because I feel like a lot of what happened, because I know it probably went a little farther than just words back then, it just felt like elite-level hating. It felt like the most negative parts of, like, Twitter or what we see anywhere else, just except it's on one media platform.
Yeah, you know, elite level hating is just called racism.
I thought that was hate for the platform.
You, like, the biggest hater of all, if you just racist, like, that just means you insecure and you upset at other people doing, like, you, it's, yeah, you're right, this is nuts.
this was probably the toughest chapter for me so far.
So for me, there one other thing stood out to me. And it was when it said, in the book, it said, although for many white sports writers, playground play suggested a lack of sophistication or even a kind of black moral failing. And that was talking about Earl the Pearl. And I heard that exact same, rhetoric being used towards Patrick Mahomes in football this year when they said, this was said this year. Patrick Mahomes is the best quarterback in the NFL, but Joe Burrow is the best quarterback.
What? That doesn't even make sense.
This was on ESPN.
Yes. Yeah,
like, this was on ESPN. And what
they should resign.
But what he was in contention for a job in the NFL this year. Like, going from analyst to a job. It was nuts, right? That line of thinking is retracting, is a modern day way of retracting the sophistication black athletes have in a position, right? In counterparts to their, or in conjunction to the white counterparts, I should say.
Yeah.
And that also showcased how far we have not come, because all that was coded language. Right? That's all it was. And if you don't understand what coded language is, that's not that crazy to think about. But this talking about Earl Monroe, right? This talking about Earl Monroe was talking about the NBA merger in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Right? We all know somebody who was alive during that time.
Oh, for sure.
In the same thought processes, these same speaking points. They went from sports writers to ESPN analysts are saying the exact same things in 2022-2023.
Oh, a lot. Like, the thing is, right, a lot of the people saying those things back then are still alive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we a lot of people, and like, there are a lot of people now who, if they were, they might not have been alive for it, but they were raised by the people that were.
Facts. I mean, it's true. Like, and that's what I think. That's what I think a lot of people just forget, right? Or like, don't remember. It's like, this is not that long ago. These people are alive, and that's why I think that Jerry Jones picture was really important. Yeah, you had people like Stephen A. Smith who were trying to, like, you know, cover up for it for whatever reason, but like, that's just an indicator. That's just an indication. Like, these people are alive. People's kids are alive. People's grandkids are alive. And if unless these people are actively combating this kind of like racist architect, then they're just living in it and believing it and perpetuating it. And, you know, that's when you have half of America voting for Trump. you know, that's when you have that.
Side note, I would just like to throw in that I thought it was hilarious that after Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and his teammate Wright got back to Milwaukee, they immediately bailed and didn't do the little interviews that was scheduled or whatever, the press conference, and just left their GM just hanging.
No, I'm imagining like Kareem trying to slink away at like 7 in on empty tarmac. It's like, dude, I can see. Are you just gonna leave?
Like, I just imagine that, like, they got there and they just, like, hopped out and took off before he could say anything.
Took off before he could say anything. It's crazy.
I guess we got to move on to something a tad bit happier. And I know it's not really happy, especially for Calvin's portion. Because we've been talking about this in the group chat. Chapter 5 Professional was a more digestible read. And I think that is a little easier of a pill to swallow, considering as a person who is like trying to make their way career-wise, you've already heard like the horror stories. So seeing how everything plays out with this, especially with Simon Gordigan, it's a gut punch, but it is one of those gut punches that you've heard the story so many times that it's kind of be like, oh, okay. That sounds about right. Very sick in its own way.
Right.
Yeah, it's professional sick.
Yeah.
Right. It's high-level business sick.
Yeah.
So, real quick, right, audience, for those who don't know, the NBA has never had a black, what's the term, commissioner?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's been white dudes all the way down. They tend to hang around a while. And while I was reading this, I did not know that. I'm not actually surprised when I found out. Like, you start reading this chapter, right? It talks about Gordine and how, like, he kind of makes his way up through the ranks and all of that. And you, at least for me, right, it was like, I know where this is going, but I hope that I am wrong.
Yeah. And look, and to give it a little bit more context for Simon Dean. Simon Dean is an esteemed lawyer at this point. Started off in something different for sports, but the minute he got into it, he got hooked. And he basically became the commissioner before him. But I can't remember his first name, but I know his last name was Kennedy. So we'll just call him.
I think it's Walter Kennedy.
Walter Kennedy basically became his right hand man. Like, had conversations with him about like, hey man, I think I'm about out of here. Maybe I can get a keys. And him being like, oh yeah, for sure. I've been thinking about that. So he's basically getting groomed for the position, and more or less gets stuffed at the end for someone who is much less
a white dude with political connections. We can be straight up about this. Part of the reason they chose the dudes that they did was in the hopes that they'd speed along the merger.
His name was O'Brien, might as well call him out, who ended up getting the job instead of Gorgeous.
I say the dudes just because, like, the thing is, the while Kennedy wanted Gordine, the owners of the teams at no point considered him a serious candidate.
Not at all, and that goes into the aspect that I talked to you guys beforehand, which is so much of these things in sports is an encapsulation of, like, a wider conversation. And the wider conversation that should be had, or not should, the wider conversation that I took away from this point was that racism cannot be combated by one person because it is a system and it is a numbers game, essentially. So one person who is anti-racist or not racist or not as racist cannot combat against nine people that are racist
because and pay his salary.
Because when you know, democracy sounds all good until, like, there's racism involved. And then all of a sudden you understand that democracy can also be, like, unless actively countered against, a negative thing because it continues to hold the less fortunate, the people with less majority, it's the continuation to hold them down, or it can be at least. And this is a perfect example of that. And I was like, man, that's annoying because, you know, we talk about Gordine. It's hilarious because at one point he goes, Gordine ultimately hoped that he could use his legal skills to reshape the NBA from within. And I just wrote next to that, classic. Like, we all know that person who's like, I'm going to join politics because I want to change this. I'm going to be a cop because I want to change the system from the inside out. And it's like, okay. But then you go into the system and the system either bogs you down or you reform to the system, right? Like, that happens so many times. And Gordine tried that to reshape from the inside, but he was in a scenario at the time where the system said, you thought, and racism ensued, and he was not able to rise to the levels of which he should have been able to go, rise to. Those are the biggest points that I personally took away from this chapter. Although, obviously, in terms of detail, there's so much detail and names that you would have not have known unless you read this chapter. Names that, you know, when time goes by, that, you know, they kind of wither away to a degree, right? But names of grave importance. And Gordine and his impact should be more well known, and I'm interested to ask the author, why does she think it's not as well known as what it is? Because I have my own suspicions, obviously, but I'm curious about her thoughts.
We've already come across a few names that I felt like were needed to be scrubbed from the history books for, like, the NBA's perception, but should have at least popped up somewhere in the last 25 to 30 years as a need to, like, pay homage. Like, anytime February come around, something needs to be said about Simon.
Because it's funny, right? Because you have this whole fight racism, you have the whole fight racism rhetoric, labeling, whatever. But I find it hilarious that if the NBA really wanted to fight racism and bring up these names, they would have to acknowledge how racist the NBA is and has been throughout its whole entire history. And that is a thing they won't do because it's bad for business.
Is it bad at this point that I feel like in the year 2023, you could say in 1967, we were kind of wilding and everybody is like, yeah. I feel like that it's that easy.
But here's the issue with that. For you to say that, or for the NBA to say that, excuse me, they would have to fully be aware of the fact that they are not racist currently. The issue is they are. That is the biggest issue. Because you can say that, but that's making a separation from the past to the present. when the separation hasn't been, when there has not been a severance yet. There is a clear lineage that goes, wow, Gordon was passed up at the time to be commissioner of the NBA and was like the protege essentially of like the commissioner at the time. And then that would have people thinking, wow, there still is no black commissioner. And then, you know, they want Adam Silver, Sterling passed. He's looked at by he's looked at as like a bad guy for many people. Sterling is or not Sterling, Silver, he is not. He's looking at the good guy. This would help. This book showcases and helps it be known that it is not about the individual, it is the system. Individuals go away, but systems tend to last. And the NBA, for them to acknowledge that the past was an issue, is them to acknowledge that the present is also an issue. And I don't, they just don't want to do that because they're business and once again, bad for business.
I just think if this feels like one of those things that go back to lazy media. Like if you gonna track mud in, at least try to help clean it up.
But once again, we're talking about media. When you say bad and good media,
ESPN, the initial story spreads faster than the retraction.
But this is also like privatized media. Like sports inherently is like private media, right? Like the main people that cover it that people listen to is like a private media. You know, they have revenue and stock, and they're Fortune 500, whatever it is, right? They're involved in all these different like ins and outs of like finance. They control the narrative. So, like, good media won't necessarily be shown to that highlight because that is the case. Mm. It's unfortunate, but it's just the reality, specifically when it comes to sports. Now, I'm talking about, like, world news, things like that. It's completely different. Like, there are certain outlets you can find that are, like, that way. But if you watch ESPN, like the majority of people do, if you just watch Fox Sports 1, you're not going to get that because – why would you get that and Skip Bayless on the exact same channel?
You got a point.
It's just sad. But once again, sports is sad. Sports is political, but you know you take what you can out of it because there are good things, but to acknowledge the good things in their heights, you got to acknowledge the bad things in their depths.
So while I'm still thinking about it, because I've already had this thought and forgot it, right? Something that is relatively frequently highlighted in the book is the tendency for the league to do things to attempt to appeal to its white fans. And right, this extends to a lot of stuff in the book. The tough on crime stuff. Right. Out here, wait, was that part two or was it part three? With Kermit Davis getting fined like $10,000 and he was suspended for
That's part
three. I mean not Davis, Washington.
That's part three, big dog. You giving away to part three.
Dang it.
Yeah. That's what you get for reading ahead.
Look, it's a good book.
Fever.
But you know, a lot of the stuff that we're gonna touch on here in a little bit, where with the whole drug thing and whatever, and like the hiring a bunch of former FBI people and stuff, stuff to kind of appease the white fans to give, and here in particular, right, the appeasing white fans means creating either the reality or, if nothing else, the illusion that they have their black players under control. Because, of course, right, black people are unruly and must be controlled. Like, but, you know, something like the NBA is not unique in this. I've observed a tendency for a lot of organizations to play into the prejudices of their target audience, more or less.
Right. I mean, listen. You are 110% correct, Calvin. I mean, that's why it was so hard. And I don't know if it's still the case, but NASCAR, it, with the Confederate flag, like that whole entire scenario, like, you cater to the fan base. Hockey allows fights because you have the glass up and it's a violent white sport, right? Like, you're catering to the
fan base. Talked about it in, she even talked about it in the book.
Like, these things are, this is for everybody, right? And you, it's, I mean, once again, that is good business. Once again, part of good business. Understanding who your fan base is and catering to them, because you cater to the fan base, you will gain more money because they'll be more invested into the product.
Something I thought I've that's been twirling around in my mind for quite a while, though, is like, is it not possible to cater to a fan base without indulging in its prejudices?
Ooh, hold on.
That is
a good one. That's a good one. Okay, hold on. I can repeat that real quick, though.
Love the person and love the culture at the same time. Yeah. You kind of have to adopt it.
Calvin, can you repeat your question real quick?
Basically, can you is it not possible to cater to a fan base without indulging in that fan base's prejudices?
I think yes, but it depends on the origin of the thing, right? Like, the origin of sports is... The origin of sports, generally speaking, is purely based off of class, right? Economics. You can, once again, you can go all the way back to Greek times. But you can also go all the way present to, there's a reason why Mexican, Black, and Italians were like the main boxers for forever. It's because they were below the poverty line. And there's a reason why traditional, just like generationally white individuals played tennis, golf, and all these things because they're country club sports, right? Mm-hmm. So if sports in America, we talk about it specifically, its origins are catered to classism, then I don't think you can separate the two. I think you could, depending on the origins. But once again, with sports and its origins being that, I'm not sure if you can separate the two.
Okay. But what I also wanted to point out is, like, as we've been talking, thinking about how the NBA has handled various things and thinking about what's that term? Virtue signaling. Right?
Right.
Basically, and maybe I'm misusing the term slightly, or maybe there's a better term for what I'm thinking of. But basically, right, doing certain things to signal a particular set of beliefs, in alignment with a certain set of beliefs. So, right, and like we often think about, like nowadays, right, we often think about the NBA as being pretty progressive, particularly as far as sports leagues go. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as I think about it, right, logically speaking, the NBA being as big as it is, Black folks aren't really the target audience still.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
So, a lot of, like, the argument could be made that a lot of the things they do in relation to, like, when we start talking about, like, politics and supporting, like, Black Lives Matter, or mm-hmm. getting rid of, what's his name? Donald something.
Sterling.
Thank you. Even like the more recent stuff in regards to like HBCUs and whatever, isn't really like they don't. And this is going to be me getting super, super cynical, and we can get back to the book here in a second, but like they don't really care about like. The NBA doesn't care about Black people. They care what white people think. They care that white people think that they care about Black people.
No, like I knew you were going to go there, and that is 1,000% correct. Now, I didn't know you were going to word it that way. Kanye, but like,
look, old Kanye was making sense. I don't know who this new guy is.
Yeah, me either. That's real though, right? It is catering. It is trying to find the comfortability because you don't actually want to do anything to ruffle feathers, because if you did, it would be kind of productive to like the business at hand. Because at the end of the day, commissioners, whatever, the owners own the NBA. The team owners own the NBA. Now, that sounds obvious, but a lot of people, for some reason, don't think this. Now, how many owners of the NBA are black?
Jordan for now.
Jordan, right? Outside of the charitable thing that Jordan has done in the last year and a half, 2 years, what has Jordan done to ruffle the feathers in a political sense that was counteractive to his capital gain at the end?
Also, Jordan ain't impressed about black folks either. We don't need to pretend.
Yes, Jordan, there was, man, I have a book up here that talks about this whole thing. But Jordan actively did things through his career when he played that wouldn't ruffle feathers because he wanted to be apolitical, right? While other people in his generation weren't, he was like, he made a conscious decision to be apolitical, point blank, period. So with him being the only black American representative in this illustrious club of ownership in the NBA, you have no choice but to understand and to acknowledge what Calvin just said. The NBA does not care about black people. They care to catering people to think they care about black people. No substance, all surface.
There were several things. I'm sorry.
All gas with you guys today. I love it.
There are several things in there, but like we should probably get back to the book.
I mean, but maybe, and once again, this is something I want to ask the author too, the historian. These types of books make you have these conversations, right? Because I'd argue this is the book showcasing that these conversations, while there are certain scenarios that happen, specific scenarios that happened in the 60s, 50s, 70s in the NBA, will continue to go forward. Those circumstances translate now. And if you can't connect those dots or you can't critically think about how those things intertwine, then you aren't taking the book at its value. And because I'm curious, like, what is the author? What does she hope the audience gains from this book? Because obviously, and who is her target audience? Is her target audience people who care about this kind of stuff like us, or is it just the common person? You know what I mean? Your average person who's just whatever, right? Because all stuff is important. But once again, this book, if you're not having these conversations we're having right now after you read this book or while you're reading this book, then you're not reading the book.
In fairness, there are some people who don't have the vocabulary or knowledge necessarily to quite have the kind of conversation that we're having.
Should have went to HBCU.
Hey, that's the perfect way to end this episode, man. Calvin, you got something else?
Wally Jones's story was in this section, right?
I don't think so.
Dang it. Okay, I gotta wait.
Overachiever is what
to
you
get. Be continued.
It's a good book. I read good books. That's how this works.
It is. It is. This book is a bang. Yo. Again, go get your copy. You can't see mine because
I got you.
This darn cat. Thank you, Cal.
I guess I don't got you.
It's the Cowboys either.
Philip, let me get it.
I got you.
Fuck up,
my friend.
Black ball.
Go get Black Ball by Teresa Runstetter so you can join us on this journey of going through this book. It's a powerful read. I can't wait to sit down with Dr. Runstetter and run through my questions, because you got your hands full. Will you come see us? I appreciate you for sending us another copy. But again, thank you guys so much for tuning into another episode of the Traveling Hoopers podcast, with the special edition coming from this book right here, Black Ball. And guys, the two people in front of me are my best friends in the world, and they're going to sign us out.
As always, I'm Calvin McGowan. It's been a pleasure to be here. I've been coming to you live from that desktop that your kindergarten teacher had back in the day. If you know you're joining us on YouTube, like, share, subscribe, leave something in the comments, and of course you can listen to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. This has been fun.
Yeah, my name is Philip Dixon, and just because you wear hoodies does not mean you can have an intellectual conversation at the same time. We appreciate you all joining us, and thank you, and I can't wait for you all to hear the next rendition of the Traveling Hoopers podcast.
You made it sound so fancy.